Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowder, and with me is my co-host, Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing today?
The two best friends you never knew you had. I am doing great, Jeff.
And on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on not life today, because today we are going to do sort of a special Breaking Kayfabe. As my wife likes to tell me, warn the folks ahead of time that it's going to be all about wrestling, because today's show is sort of a special look at the life and legacy of Dick Slater, who we lost very recently at the time of this recording. Barry, of course, Slater, got to be one of the all-timers in the pantheon of Florida wrestling.
Yeah, he absolutely was, too. And, you know, with Dick Slater, too, he was a guy, we've said this numerous times, I think every time Dick Slater's name comes up, we say it. Here was a guy that was probably better than the majority of professional wrestlers right out of the gate. He was a guy that within the first 6 months of his career was headlining and main eventing in the smaller towns, and within a year, maybe a year and a half, was main eventing or semi-main event in the big towns like Tampa and Miami Beach and Jacksonville. So he had the it factor, and it was right apparent from the get-go. And I have no problem telling you, Dick Slater, in the period of the mid-70s up until the late-70s, was really one of my favorite wrestlers. I can tell you he also had the respect of a lot of other wrestlers. I've mentioned before, you know, being a part of professional wrestling as a fan, I was running fan clubs, and I ran the Rocky Johnson fan club. And there was a period in 1978 when Dick was the Southern heavyweight champion in the state of Florida, as well as the TV champion. And he had come back to the state as a babyface, and he turned heel in his first match back, which was a television match against Pedro Morales, and he won the title. And I remember I was talking to Rocky Johnson one night, and it was in Miami, and we were talking about Dick Slater, and I said, you know, Dick Slater is just, I think he's just a really good wrestler. And that was me, you know, who runs a fan club for one of the top baby faces, saying that, you know, I think this heel is really good. And Rocky looked at me and he goes, he really is. He's like human chess. Every move that he does, it means something. And that was, you know, now we hear the human chess, and it's certainly a cliche, but 40 years ago when he said that to me, it made an impact, so much so that I remember it 40 years later. So Dick Slater was a talent, you know, and there was a crazy Dick Slater outside of the ring. But if you saw Dick Slater in his heyday, and I'm going to say his heyday was the 1970s, you know, in the 80s, I think, you know, there was this Terry Funk thing that he was doing, and then certainly going to the WWF, that was just a terrible gimmick. I know he spent some time in the AWA, but he also battled a lot of injuries. And Dick's back, which I think ultimately is what landed him in the wheelchair and may or may not have contributed to his death, but I know that his back was just completely done. He had nothing there anymore. And you could see it in the 80s as well, and certainly into the late 80s as he was part of a tag team with Dick Murdoch. He wasn't the same guy. He was certainly a veteran at that point. But I will stand by this. The Dick Slater that I saw in the early to mid-70s, one of the best professional wrestlers I think I have ever seen.
Yeah, and, you know, let's be honest, folks, there is a very, I will say, he's a very polarizing figure. While Dick Slater was an extremely talented man in the ring, outside the ring, I think it's fair to say that Dick had his demons. He was a man who was, I don't want to say a complicated man, but he was a man who had some certain issues that some people had problems addressing. We were talking before we began recording about various wrestling pages and sites that have been demonizing Dick Slater. We are not here to cast judgment on the Dick Slater outside the ring. We are here to discuss Dick Slater inside the ring and his career. I think passing judgment on Dick Slater is, quite frankly, Barry, above my pay grade, and it involves somebody else that he may have to answer to eventually. But on that note, what we're going to do here today, folks, is we are going back and we are going to talk to two men that knew Dick Slater as a wrestler. And one of them who grew up with Dick Slater was one of his childhood friends back in his Robinson High School days. And we're going to talk to Steve Kern and Bob Roop. And so what we're going to do first is we're going to talk to Steve Kern. We appreciate Steve taking some time out of his day to discuss Dick's life and legacy. So right now, Barry, how about we go listen to Steve Kern talk about his friend Dick Slater?
Fabulous.
Okay, we are here with a special segment of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry. We are very happy to be joined by Steve Kern, a true championship wrestling from Florida wrestling legend. And we are here, unfortunately, as great as it is to have Steve with us, we are here to talk, unfortunately, about the passing, the death of Dick Slater, another CWF and overall wrestling legend, as is Steve. And Barry, I think you mentioned that Steve had posted something recently in the CWF Archives group. Why don't you talk about that, and we'll get Steve's thoughts on the life and times of Dick Slater.
Yeah, absolutely, too. It's an honor, too. It's always an honor to have Steve in our group. And he posted something when we posted the obituary of Dick Slater just a few days ago. And Steve's words were, "So sad to see the passing of a great friend. Always sad to reflect on their memories. Slater was the toughest guy to ever come out of Robinson High School. Another junior mafia member down. We bought the back page in the 1969 Robinson High School yearbook back section. God bless, Steve Kern." So Steve, can you give us a little backstory on what exactly the junior mafia was?
Yeah, you know what it was? It was just a bunch of guys in high school, and we all thought we were tough guys, and we lived south of anything in Tampa. We're called Soggs, which is south of Gandy, anything below Gandy Boulevard. And in that era, I mean, you know, there wasn't that much, you know, like violence and everything, but we'd get out on Friday, Saturday night and then get together and then end up in a fight somewhere at a Royal Castle or a late night restaurant or whatever. And we thought we were the men, right? So we had this little group, and the guy that kind of was ahead of everything was a kid named Leo Mattacini, and his dad was in the mafia. So that's where the junior mafia thing came. But you know, when you reflect back, like I said in what I wrote on your Facebook, it's kind of like you go through a big flash of the memories you had of certain people. And Dick Slater stood out so much because he was the toughest guy ever come out of that area down there. And everybody thought that was tough, and I think Slater was probably the only one that was tough. But that's how, you know, that was what I was reflecting on. And Mike Graham, of course, was in the picture, and Austin Idol, Dennis McCord, I don't think he was in the picture, but he did go to Robinson. He was a year older than us. So
anyway. Steve, if you could reflect, do you remember when you met Dick Slater? I mean, obviously it was in high school, but it was like, you know, 9th, 10th, sophomore year, junior year, like approximately when?
Yeah, it was my 10th grade year. We actually went to rival junior highs in South Tampa. He went to Madison and I went to Monroe. And then, you know, there was like, it was a 50-50 split. And when you came together and you went to Robinson, the other high school in that vicinity was a high school called Plant High School, is where all the wealthy kids went. It was a higher influential area, and the kids there seemed to, you know, have a lot more, but whatever. But the Robinson kids, well, you know, they were kind of like really a tight group. And most of the guys that are in the pictures, most of the guys that I grew up with were either dealing with, you know, broken families, you know, dad, no dad, mom, no mom, whatever. So, you know, it was like the parental guidance was pretty low at that time. But, you know, we didn't get really in any big trouble, but that's just kind of the way it went. But Dick Slater, and no matter what part of town we were in, he had built a reputation from being in high school as one of the toughest guys anybody had ever run across. I met him in the 10th grade because of the two schools coming together, but we hit it off right off the bat. I mean, I like this guy. You know, who are you going to hang out with, the toughest guy or the guys that are going to get you beat up? I mean, you know, it was kind of iffy sometimes because when Slater get in a fight, you're wondering, well, I don't really want to fight this other guy because he's like big. But, I mean, you know, he was a cool guy. And then I worked with him in the summer between the 10th and the 11th grade. His dad was actually a stepdad, owned a concession on Tampa Municipal Beach where they rented these little sailboats. And they're really horrible to, you know, rent because if they only sail one way, and we'd sit out there and rent them to the tourists and everything. So we got pretty tight back then. Anyway, that's a meeting of Dick Slater.
Yeah. So, and, you know, Dick has always been one of those guys, and it's such a rare thing to happen in the business that, you know, I've always heard that from day one, he just got it and was just a great hand in the ring. And, you know, after that first year, they were already talking about him as a potential, you know, guy down the road that would be the NWA world champion.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I can't walk in anybody else's shoes, and I'm not about to try to. And I don't really know what happened with Dick. I don't know, you know, how his life led him or whatever. I heard rumors, you know, after I left Florida wrestling here, I don't know about the third time going to Georgia or Carolinas or whatever, I just didn't cross, you know, territories with Dick again. I mean, which I spent a lot of time in Tennessee and Minneapolis and some of the Carolinas and some of the other territories. But the only time that I really crossed was when he was with Bob Orton Jr. and they were in Atlanta, and I was in there a short time with them. So, and then plus Dick was a heel, and in those days, baby faces and heels didn't ride together. It was really kayfabe. So, you know, you didn't spend as much time together.
Yeah, Dick had a hell of a run in Florida, and as Jeff had just mentioned, too. So he was one of those guys, and, you know, I do so much research when it comes to CWF, but Dick was one of those guys that he got the push right out of the gate. And even within 6 months of his pro wrestling career, he was already headlining in some of the smaller towns like Lauderdale and Fort Myers. But within a year, he was getting main events even in cities like Tampa, and then he formed that tag team with Dusty Rhodes, which I think was right around your first or second year in the business. But you guys were together in Florida in 1978, and I think that was, unfortunately, right around the same time that you suffered the broken leg. But I saw a couple of matches that you guys had, which was absolutely unbelievable. So in your opinion, in seeing Dick Slater, and there were really two different versions of Dick Slater from, you know, that I saw. There was the early Dick Slater, and then there was a later Dick Slater. And the story's always been, and Terry Funk has even told me this personally, that Dick Slater kind of copied him in a bit as far as his mannerisms in the ring. What's your impression of that?
Well, it's something that, you know, you pick up styles from other people. When we were taught, we were all taught the same here in Florida. We got beat up for 6 months trying to figure out what we were actually learning. And then all of a sudden we got smartened up, and then now we're starting to work. But Slater, you know, followed his instructions. Guys would tell us, hey, listen, watch the matches. When your match is done, get right back out there and watch every match. Learn stuff. Watch what gets over. Watch what doesn't get over. Watch who's over. Watch what the audience's reaction. Try to figure this out. Well, Slater did that. He watched Terry Funk. He watched Dick Murdoch. He watched guys that went out there and you know, worked with just such a finesse and just a comfort zone that's what he emulated. But we're not the beginners of any of our movement or anything. It's just we take a little bit from different people. I'm as guilty as anybody. But what I tried to teach when I was running the developmental is just take a little bit, like take one little thing from five different guys that you admire, and now you've got a whole new guy. But don't take signature movements and stuff like that, which he did. Dickie kind of infringed on that with Terry and with Dick Murdoch. But that was him. And you know, back in those days, to be honest with you, nobody looked like it. Looked at it like you were trying to steal something. Everybody kind of looked at it like we're all trying to figure this out. And the minute you left this territory and you went to Atlanta, you could use everything you'd compiled, and you're not stepping on anybody's toes, unless they come in the next week after you've already started doing their stuff. But, I mean, you know, it's just kind of like trying to figure out who you are. Wrestling was very difficult. You're doing 7 nights a week, average 9 times, like with televisions and stuff like that. And you're traveling nonstop with 7 days. And you're in the car with guys that are giving you advice, some good, some bad. You got to be smart enough to figure out what's the good, what's the bad, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, and then try to form relationships with people that would, you know, kind of take you under their wing. Dick Slater had Terry Funk took him under his wing. As a matter of fact, the minute I found out Dick had passed, I called Terry to tell him. I'm the guy that called him and told him. And then, you know, so we talked for quite a while, and he loved Dick Slater. He came looking for him a couple years ago because nobody had heard from him, and went over to Clearwater and went to a couple places he supposedly hung out and never found him. So, I mean, you know, I don't want to get off track. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No. You know, I mean, obviously, we when someone passes, we take time, and we're of course all sad for our, you know, for his family's loss. For losing him and the memories of him. But, you know, we also want to look back fondly and remember some of the stuff about Dick. And not only was he a great wrestler in the ring, but of course, Steve, I don't think we can talk about Dick Slater without talking about some of the stories about Dick outside the ring. And Lord knows there were more than one of those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, that's what I was saying. From the time, you know, I started circulating territories, I wasn't sure if once I didn't see Dick anymore, it's like it's out of sight, out of mind. I was real close with Randy Savage, and Randy had a greatest saying about the relationships in the wrestling business. He said, "Brother, it doesn't matter when we see each other again. It's an unconditional friendship for life." And that is the most unreal statement, but it sunk in on me because that's the truth. I have a million really close friends in the business because I'm blessed to have been in it for so long. But I don't pick up the phone and call every one of them, you know, on a weekly basis or try to stay in touch. If I run across them at an autograph session, then we sit and talk and reminisce. But, you know, it's just life's tough and you got enough things going on in your own personal life than to try to be buddies with everybody.
Yeah. So, well, let me ask you one of the stories that I've always heard that, you know, when you ask people about Dick Slater, is the story about the night that Dick ran into John Matuszak, who played, of course, for years in the NFL. And I got to ask you, were you there that night?
No.
Okay. No. You know the story I'm talking about?
Well, I kind of know it only because of hearsay, but I'm not positive. You might even know more of it than I do.
Well, so the story goes, and Barry, chime in if I'm saying anything incorrectly.
This is when Matuszak was at the University of Tampa.
Yes, and he was, of course, ended up being
and Ron Mikulocek too.
And Matuszak ends up being the number one pick in the NFL draft his senior year. But Matuszak was working as a bouncer at a bar, and apparently Slater went there one night with some friends, and he may not have been of legal age yet. I hate when that happens. And so Matuszak, as the bouncer, tries to escort young Dick out. And apparently, I don't know whether or not Dick had a beer or two, but Dick decided he wasn't going to allow John Matuszak, who was about 6'8 and about 275 pounds, he wasn't going to allow John to just toss him out of the place. So they got in quite the scrap, to the point where the story goes that John Matuszak ran away from his job, went back to his apartment or his dorm room, and then Slater followed him to his apartment and began kicking on the door, telling him to come out and finish the fight. And Matuszak was finally heard to say, "Please go away. Please leave me alone." Does that sound like something Dick would do?
Well, it actually does. But, you know, I could tell you one thing that, you know, because I was right there a lot of times when the first blow was thrown in the little street fights you had as kids. And it was usually Dick Slater, who was probably the least intimidating looking of all of us. He had a pudgy face, like a pie face, like a baby face, and he didn't look tough. But his secret was he threw unbelievable punches, and every one of them landed, and he wasn't even a boxer. It was just a natural thing. It's like you said about his career in the wrestling business. He was such a natural. He wasn't just a natural fighter. And that, you know, but I believe that about Matuszak because in Florida, and you might know this, Barry, is like at the end of the school year when you're in high school, right after you finish the last week, you go to the beach for a week. Everybody goes over to the beaches over here, and it's called Beach Week. Well, that's nothing but a thing for high school kids to get drunk and get in fights in. And that's kind of what it was. And I seen Slater fight guys that were from colleges that didn't realize it when, you know, after the fight, so I was like, oh, man, who's that guy? That guy's a junior in high school over in Tampa. And this would be like a big offensive lineman from Michigan State or something, you know, and actually picked the fight with him. And that was a big mistake. But I never saw Dick Slater get hit. I mean, you know, and I was there a lot of times. I never saw him get hit in the face. I never saw him get punched. It was always the first one or two were from him, and the rest was just following the guy to the ground.
So anyway, you don't know.
But
you I don't believe the
Matuszak story. I believe the Matuszak story because I know Eddie was messing with the University of Tampa about that time as we were all breaking into the business. Because he had the coach on the wrestling team coming over. And we were looking at a guy, Fletcher Carr, was a wrestler there at the University of Tampa that had some potential, but then it kind of didn't pan out. He drafted guys like, you know, Ron Simmons. There was a guy, Dewey Forte, and Lex Luger, all of those guys at the same time, you know. So they were always looking for guys. And it just happened to fall into that Matuszak's era when he was kind of a tough guy. And I know he beat up a few of the University of Tampa football players because I've heard those stories. But, you know, he was just a second step from college, from high school. You know, we'd already gone to the main event. Now we're running in serious business. And another guy that really loved Slater that comes to mind, too, was Harley. Harley Race loved Dick Slater. He rode with him all the time. And I wouldn't ride with Harley. I'd be terrified. But Harley would drive 120 miles an hour just to meet you at the corner. I mean, you know, his idea of like a good night on the road was out running the highway patrolman, turning around back under an overpass and coming back on a side road. I mean, you know, wait a minute. I just want to get home.
So it seems like a lot of the legitimate tough guys in professional wrestling were actually hanging out together then. Because if you've got Harley and Slater and Terry Funk and Murdoch, it sounds like, you know, I could just imagine, you know, I turn legal drinking age, which at that time was 18, and I go into a bar, and there's legit four of the toughest guys in the United States. Oh, man, that's crazy.
Yeah, and that's funny you say that, too, because, Haku has a reputation of one of the toughest guys in the wrestling business. But when I first met him, he came to Florida as a young kid from the islands, and he was Prince Tonga. And he didn't look like anybody. I mean, he didn't look like he was going to be one of the toughest guys in the whole wrestling business. Because then I ribbed him right off the bat. I run an armadillo down on the way to West Palm on the side of that turnpike there, me and Paul Orndorff, and we caught it, put it in the trunk, and then when we got to West Palm dressing room, we stuck it in Tonga's bag. Well, he still tells that story, and every time he tells it, I'm always wondering, if he has any revenge in him that he'd like to just take me out for that. Because I always say, you know, how did I know you were going to end up being one of the toughest guys in the wrestling business? So, anyway.
So,
yeah,
well,
I remember those days too. And Tonga was. So another guy that we were just talking about guys that played football at the University of Tampa. And I don't want to get too far off of Dick Slater, but there was a guy named Irvin Smith, Rip Smith, that had a very short career in wrestling, but he looked like he was going to be a star. I happened to see some of his early matches in 75, and I thought he was going to be great. And then he just disappeared within 2 years.
Yeah, you know, I got to be honest, there's a lot of guys that come up and, you know, when people bring their names up and everything, I spent, you know, over 40 years full time in this business and I crossed a lot of paths with people and I know exactly the name and I remember the guy. But at that time, my opinion on what was good and bad wasn't really creditable. I mean, you know, I'm trying to figure out myself what's going to work for me, but he did something kind of weird. I think he wrestled with his legs, like doing a lot of leg trips or stuff. But he was another athlete from this area down in here in Central Florida. So I don't know what happened to him either. There were several of those guys. I remember a guy that played football for Miami Dolphins. His name was Bob Bruggers. When I was in the Carolinas, he was in an airplane accident with Flair and all of them and broke his back, and I never heard from him again either.
He actually lives down here in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah.
Does he?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, but he had a lot of potential. He held an athlete. He was catching on pretty quick, and the promotions liked him.
And, you know, you mentioned name, you know, obviously a guy from Tampa that we haven't talked about is Paul Orndorff, you know, another guy with a tremendous reputation outside the ring, needless to say.
Oh, yeah. I'd pay money to watch Emmett Slater fight. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, and I'd pay a lot, too, because I'd want to be up close. But Paul was a real stud. He was just, you know, well, he still is. I mean, you know, but in that day, in that era, you know what? Let me tell you a funny story about Paul. I don't want to get off the track and waste you guys' time, but I got a really funny story when he first started. He first started, he rode with me and Jimmy Garvin, and we were making the trips, and we were kind of driving him crazy because we were pretty comfortable at that time. But he wrestled in, I want to say, Orlando. He didn't wrestle in Tampa because if there was another town that night, Fort Myers, and you'd have to drive to that one if you weren't that good. And he wrestled in Tallahassee. And I was with him in Tallahassee. And he couldn't figure out how to get a 1-2 count. And I guess that's the best way to say it. Because every night he was supposed to go over and he'd lean his shoulders down to try to make it exciting. And the ref would go, 1-2. And then they just kind of look at him like, 3. And he'd get counted out. He got counted out every night for the first 4 matches that he had. And he was supposed to go over. And Paul would be so upset when he come in the back, you know, he goes, I know it was only 2. I know he only counted 2. I know. And I stood out there and watched him. I mean, you know, he was a very excitable guy and easy to manipulate so far as making him feel bad all the way home from Tallahassee about getting beat. So then they can ever push you. You can't even win your beginning matches.
So let me ask you, when you were in, I don't know if you were actually in Mid-South, but I know you worked a lot in Houston. You and Stan had a program with the Guerreros down there. Was that at the time that Dick was in Mid-South, and I think he might have even been booking? Was that in the same time frame?
Don't know for sure. I don't really know. Like I said, I didn't keep track.
I didn't know if Dick was on those Houston cards with you. That's why I'm asking.
Oh, no. He wasn't. You're talking about Mid-South. Are you talking about the Charlotte territory?
No, I'm talking about when, you know, the guys in Mid-South would work Houston for Paul Bosch. And I know that you and Stan worked a couple matches against the Guerreros in Houston.
Yeah. Yeah, we were working for Bill Watts. Bill Watts was flying us in to work with the Guerreros and everything. We only came in for like 3 shots.
Okay.
One of them was, I didn't see Dickie at any of those shots. I don't know if he was out there or not. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have been out there because I would have seen him. But, you know, again, separate dressing rooms.
Separate
cars. You didn't, you know, sometimes even if you knew a guy that was on the card and he was one of your friends, if he's in a separate dressing room, chances are you ain't gonna see him while you're there that short time. But, yeah. Yeah, Bill Watts almost got me killed down there in Brownsville, wrestling the Guerreros. I can't believe it. We did a paint your opponent yellow match, and he tells me, he says, man, when you get that paintbrush, I don't want you to just dab it on him. I want you to take Chavo and paintbrush his face. And you have to tell me twice. Man, he was so mad, he jumped right up from being out cold. But the crowd, it was safer for me getting out through the crowd than it had done the week before. But anyway.
Well, let me ask you, we don't want to get off the Dick Slater topic, but while I have you here, Steve was one of our guests at the dinners that I wrote about in my book, Breaking Kayfabe, the Dinner with the Legends of Wrestling. And Steve, of all the people that we had dinner with, probably told the greatest story. Steve, if you don't mind, could you tell us a story about the rib you played on Kurt Hennig in Memphis?
Oh, bless his heart. He really wanted to get me back, too. That's the only thing about playing good ribs on people. You become a target. I mean, you know, it's like, okay, Kurt Hennig. If you could take out Kern, that means you take out Kern and Kurt Hennig. But anyway, we're real comfortable in Memphis. And at that time, I liked talking to the policemen in the back at all the buildings. I mean, you got, you know, matches you're watching and stuff like that, but it's kind of boring a lot of times when you're there in the back. And so I talked to cops, and they'd tell me all the stories of things going on. Well, I made friends with all of them, too. You know, hey, buddy, hey, you know, I know a first name. Well, I had a bunch of them really close in Memphis. Every Monday night, I'd go out there and sit and talk with them. Well, Kurt was coming to wrestle Jerry Lawler. And back then, of course, there's no cell phones. There was no security at the airport. You could walk right out to the terminal and watch people get off the plane. And so I got with the Memphis Police Department, and we came up with an idea to swear out a warrant for Kurt Hennig. And I had all the information, like his address, you know, of course, his age, name, everything that they needed. And then they came up with the idea that a father would claim that he overheard his daughter saying that he had sex with Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig. And so he was filing the charges on Kurt Hennig having sex with an underage minor. Anyway, the police officer that we used to arrest Kurt getting off the airplane was perfect. He was about maybe 6'4", 6'5". He was huge, but he was fat. I mean, he wasn't really in good shape, but he looked like this big redneck cop. And he had a real attitude, real southern accent and everything. Anyway, Kurt goes to get off the airplane. Now, I'm hiding right there where he gets off behind a post. And I'm watching Kurt. And the cop's standing right there at the door. And when Kurt comes through the door coming out into the terminal, he says, "Are you Kurt Hennig?" And Kurt goes, "Yeah." Now, Kurt thinks he's wanting to shake hands with him like it's a greeting, you know, that he likes him. And Kurt sticks out his hand and says, "How are you?" And he goes, "I always shake your hand. You're under arrest." He goes, "Arrest?" And he goes, "What for?" And he goes, "Well, read the warrant." And he served him with the warrant. And I watched Kurt read the warrant. And he got the statutory rape. And he goes, "Hey, this is wrong." He's going, and it's like, what a panic. He says, "I never even been to Memphis. There ain't no way." He says, "This is all wrong. This can't be true." And he goes, "Well, I'm just going to tell you one thing, Mr. Hennig. We're going to leave this airport, you and me, and there's two ways we can leave it. I will walk with you, escorting you out the door and put you in a police car, and I will arrest you. Or if you don't feel that's good enough, I'll drag your phony wrestling ass all through this airport by your hair." Kurt's like freaking out because that this guy was so serious. "What are you going to do, argue with a police officer at an airport?" So Kurt's going, no, I'll go with you. Now he goes out and he gets in the car. Now I ran and got in the car, and I start following him. Now I can see Kurt in the backseat of this police car, and he's got his hands up like he's telling the guy something. And the policeman told me later on, he says, it was the funniest thing. He goes, "Man, I never even been to Memphis." He says, "How can this be happening to me? I got to wrestle Jerry Lawler tomorrow night." He's going, "No, you ain't going to wrestle Jerry Lawler. You're going to be in jail." And then he goes, no, I can't. He's telling me, he says, "I got a wife and three kids, and I got four kids." And then he's like, he's all confused. And anyway, so the police officer says, now we're on the way downtown. The police officer says to him, says, "Well, maybe if you called the dad and explained on the phone to the dad, you know, that this was a mistaken identity thing." So he says, yeah. So he pulled over. And I pulled over into like a convenience store right there. You had to get out and actually put money in a box and you dialed the phone back then. So anyway, he goes to get out. Now I pulled right up beside him. Now when the police officer is pulling him out of the car, I hit my down on my power window, right? And I look at him and say, "Hey, where are you going?" And he looks at me, he's handcuffed in the front. He goes, oh man, you're not gonna believe this. The shit is on. I go, "What?" He goes, "This guy's arresting me." I go, "What did you do? You just got here." Anyway, I got out of the car and he goes, "He's arresting me here. Look. And so he hands me the warrant. So I start looking at the warrant, right? And Kern, I'd never seen him. He was always such a cool character. And so, but he was shaking. And he goes, tell him. I said, "Whatever, let me read it." So then when I got to the part, I go, yeah, I wrote this part. And right here, this is me. I'm the judge. I'm the guy that signed this thing right here. Now, it kind of comes into Kurt's mind, what I just said. And he looks at me, and he turns and looks at the cop, and the cop's laughing. So now he starts chasing me. We went around that store about 3 times, and he's screaming he's going to kill me. And about the third time, he just broke down laughing, and the police officer took the handcuffs off, and that was the red. I still have the warrant. I kept that as a souvenir.
So, well, I always heard Kurt was a great river, but you put one over on the great river himself, huh?
Well, I did, but it was dangerous. You know what I mean? Because you step out and you actually, rims are good if you can remain anonymous. I mean, you know, that's the best. But then when you're exposed, now you become a target. We used to go to Wade Boggs' Christmas party together all the time down here. He had always awesome Christmas party, and Kurt lined me up for the swimming pool on the dance floor one time, and he says, "Yeah, it's just going to blow right through everybody and knock you right in the swimming pool." I go, "Okay." And he goes, "That was to get back at you." And then I start thinking, well, then it's his turn. I don't want to go through nothing like that again. So my rebuttal.
So.
Well, Dickie Slater, we've got the wrestling business. We missed a guy that could have taught a lot of people a lot of things. I mean, you know, wrestling is taught by experience in the ring. I mean, you know, as long as I've been teaching it, Dick Slater would have been a great example to have film of, to watch for WWE's NXT or whoever, wrestling schools around the country, to pick up ideas of what a guy looks like comfortable in the ring. And he was a great performer. You know, the part about the wrestling business through my era with Dickie was, though, it was so kayfabe that Dick was not 9 times out of 10, he was a heel and I was a babyface. It wasn't until later on when I got into characters and stuff that I was a heel more, but I didn't see Dick anymore after that. But it's sad. I mean, you know, the things I heard about him, you know, like rumors and stuff, that he was in a wheelchair, that he had had a lot of medical issues. I mean, you know, that to me is, that's the hard part. It's a hard part for guys to accept once they, where they were in their lives and confidence and, you know, being able to do things. And then all of a sudden you're being shut down and being confined to something like wheelchairs or, I mean, you know, not being able to walk or whatever, you know, must have drove him crazy.
Yeah. Dick had made, he had made a couple personal appearances, and this was going back 5 or 6 years ago when he was at a fan fest in Charlotte, and he was in a wheelchair, and I think a lot of his health issues initially were related to back issues. He had severe back problems, which I think he had had during his wrestling career as well. And he had put on a lot of weight. And I know that he had been in and out of nursing homes over the last few years in the Tampa Bay area. And we had actually tried to locate Dick when we were doing our first fan fest about a year and a half ago, as we wanted to do some sort of fundraiser for him, but we had no luck in finding him. And I got to tell you, there were certain people that made an impression on me when I was a kid. I started going to wrestling in 1971. And, you know, Dick was definitely one of those guys. He was one of those guys that I first saw as a heel, then I saw him as a babyface, and obviously he changed in the state of Florida roles all the time, but he shined. Whatever he did, Dick was one of those guys that was just a pure, legitimate talent. So I was really saddened to hear of his passing. But so I have a question for you, Steve. It's going to be a little off topic, and Jeff and I tend to do that a lot. We'll get on topic, and then we'll get off topic, and we'll get back on topic, and we're all over the board. But a lot of it is it's us having fun and having a good time. But so to that end, there was always the story that you were in consideration, yourself and Bob Backlund, to be the WWF champion. And I don't think I've ever asked you this personally, and I don't think we asked you this at the last Fan Fest. So I definitely want to ask you. And then the second part of that I want to ask you is, was there ever any consideration in making you a heel in the state of Florida?
I'll go through the second part first. No, most of the time when I was in Florida, there was a shortage of baby faces. And what I mean by that, and this is kind of like point blank, there was a shortage of white meat, pie-eating, all-American boy baby faces. There was conglomeration baby faces and stuff, but at the same time, Eddie, who I worked under most of the time, was, you know, hey, you're going to be in this role. You're going to follow the guys like Briscoe and those guys. You need to be, we need baby faces that takes forever to build a baby face. And then turning them heel was always a good spark, but they never really suggested to me turning heel. The only time I ever really did that was here with Brian Blair when they tried to revive the Armory one time, and I worked in a tag match with him and turned on him. But, you know, it was just a short thing. But going back to the Bob Backlund story there, it was probably at the prime of my career so far as figuring out how to do things and then understanding the key ingredient to the whole secret, in my opinion, and wrestling's just an opinion. Everybody has one. We all have a different, some of us different, but it's an opinion, is that emotion is what the people want, not movement. You know, everybody wants to learn a lot of moves. I've taught a lot of people how to wrestle. And 9 times out of 10, they go, how many moves can you teach me? Well, how many moves are there? I can teach you every move, you know, because we'll just figure it out. But it's not about movement. It's about emotion. And so I had clicked on emotion. I had clicked on an angle with Bob Brute, my dad, you know, being a prisoner of war in that angle. It emotionally moved the audience. They weren't mesmerized by Steve Kern's movement in the ring. They were mesmerized by emotion and heart. And that's what sold tickets. And that really had the impact on the audience, you know. So when I started figuring those things out, and it took experience, it took 6-7 years of traveling territories and watching matches and listening and trying to figure out how people make money, all of a sudden it became a commodity. I mean, you know, so back then it was Vince Sr., and he wanted to drop a junior, a lightweight, or I don't know, I guess the NWA had a world lightweight championship, and I don't know if Danny Hodge had it, and Nelson Royal had it. I wrestled Nelson Royal for it one time in West Palm or Fort Lauderdale or something. But, I mean, they were having a problem, Vince Sr. and Leroy McGuirk, manipulating the belt. And, of course, Leroy McGuirk's in the NWA, and Vince Sr. was, you know, there was a different federation up there. But Eddie always worked with them. Eddie liked Vince Sr. So they came up, and Vince wanted to make ties with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And Inoki and Fujinami, those were the top stars over there. Well, I was a perfect match for Fujinami to go wrestle with him in Japan because I was experienced. I had been there several times. I kind of understood how to wrestle Japanese style a little bit more. Aggressive style. But anyway, Vince Sr. sent me a title and told me, I want you to drop that in Japan. And after you come back from Japan, I want you to come to New York and I want you to work for me. Well, to be honest with you, I wasn't really excited about that because I always had this kind of like intimidation of them cities up there and finding the buildings and everything. I'm thinking, oh my God, man, New York City, I'm not going to find a Coliseum there or Madison Square Garden. But it was, I had a fear in my mind, you know, that that was something I was really excited about and didn't look at an opportunity in those days. I was looking more at time and cars and how long I was going to be traveling. Well, I went to Japan and I worked against Fujinami. I did my job. I, you know, dropped the title to him. Now, when I came home, Dusty and Eddie told me to come down to the Sportatorium. So when I went down to the Sportatorium, Dusty and Eddie said, hey, listen, there's been a change of plans. Vince doesn't want you to come up there anymore. He says, we're going to, you know, I've been partners with Bobby Backlund for about 6-7 months at one time, too, right then before I'd gone to Japan. He says, we're going to send Bobby up there in your place. And I'm going, okay. He says, we want you to stay here. We're going to put every title we got on you right here. Then you're going to get everything. TV title, Florida title, tag team title, brass knucks title. I mean, you know, they're just going to load me up. And that was kind of satisfying me in my mind. I mean, you know, here's a guy starting, Eddie Graham. There's Dusty that I really admired and looked up to. And I'm thinking, this is all for my benefit. Well, anyway, I stayed in Florida, and I ran, and then I made money. But when Bobby went up there, Kevin Sullivan was up there. Now, Kevin Sullivan I didn't see for maybe 4 or 5 years after that. But Kevin and I were friends, and Kevin pulled me aside, and he says, hey, why didn't you come to New York? Man, they had you set up to be tag team partner with Andre the Giant all over. And I really liked Andre. I mean, you know, I drove him around when he came to Florida, so I was a good friend of his. But he said, you'd have got over like unreal. And he says, I know they had plans to put that strap on you. And, you know, to be honest with you guys and up front about the whole thing, I didn't ever know what was true and what wasn't. I can't honestly say that Vince Sr. had, you know, was going to do the same thing with me. I mean, it's just the way the story goes. And I just felt like if you understood wrestling in those days, when promoters liked you and wanted to put time in you, it's kind of like a bird in the hand, opposed to going and trying to figure out another territory and establish yourself, and especially if you're not comfortable. And I'd been to the Gardens twice. I mean, you know, I'd gone up there and worked from Florida Wrestling. I went with Dusty both times, as a matter of fact. I mean, first time I was in there, I was so excited. I come running to Dusty. I said, look, I'm in the main event in Madison Square Garden. It's my first time here. And Dusty looks at me and he goes, you eat the main event, you dumbass. He goes, the main event goes on before the intermission. He said, you're one of the extra matches after the intermission if anybody's still here. So that put a big dent in my bubble right there. I mean, you know, the main event's at the intermission. That's when they can get out of the building and everything. Anyway, but the story was told to me by Kevin. And Kevin, you know, I trust Kevin was telling me the truth. But even Andre asked me, hey, boss, how come you not come? You know, you've been my partner. And I'm going, hey, just a miscommunication thing. But, you know, when I look back and reflect on it, I'm not upset. I mean, you know, I didn't get upset with Dusty when I found out about it. I didn't get upset with Eddie. I just said, well, you know, it's just kind of business. And it worked out. I didn't have to go.
Yeah, well, you told me.
I put you guys to sleep, right?
You told me once that in the retrospect that because you weren't so much of a quote unquote New York City guy, you were more of a Florida boy. So you weren't that upset about not going. I don't know if that still holds true, but you did tell me that at the dinner. I don't know if you recall.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm really saying. I mean, you know, people, and, you know, I have a lot of friends that let things bother them, that's happened to them. But professional wrestling is a business. I mean, you know, and nobody knows it as much as I do. And when you start worrying about what you did and what you should have done, and you start comparing yourself to other people and all of that, the only one that bothers is you. You to carry that weight on your mind and on your shoulders, oh, I should have done this or I should have done that, says, hey, you know what? And you can always say it could have been worse. I mean, they sent me to Guatemala when I was like 19 years old. I'd only been in the business 3 months, and they sent me to Guatemala for 6 weeks. I should have been more mad about that. Nobody picked me up at the airport. I sat on my suitcase for 2 days. Didn't speak a lick of Spanish. I couldn't communicate.
Didn't your taxi roll over too?
Yeah, they turned it over.
Because you were wearing a hood, right?
I had no idea. It was only 50 cents to get into the matches there at the Olympic Art Club. They got me a mask the very first day of there. They're going, hey, you got to wear this mask. And, you know, that they were all doing sign language because nobody spoke any English then. And I'm going, no, I don't wear a mask. You know, and I'm trying to tell them, no, I got a pretty face. And the guy goes, put the mask on. Anyway, put the mask on and... nobody spoke English in the dressing rooms. It was all Spanish. And I'm in there with some Mexican guys, and I think they felt sorry for me. They looked at me, this guy don't know nothing. So they took me to the doorway of the arena, and they said, and they're pointing at their eyes, and they're pointing at the crowd, so they want me to watch, right? So when they got introduced, they introduced the guys, and I don't know what they're saying, but the guy's speaking Spanish. Mexico, and they open the door and they run about 10 steps into the arena and then backpedaled as fast as they could. And it looked like rain. It was oranges and rocks, and they were throwing everything they could throw. And then when it looked like it slacked off, they took off running. So a lot of people are reloading, trying to get their hands back in their pockets. The guys made it to the ring. Well, if I hadn't seen that, I would have probably just stepped out there and got pelted with everything, you know, but I was smart to it. And I mean, you know, the whole experience over there, the cab turnover, that was the next to the last week, and everybody got bloody, and all of a sudden now I'm the biggest bad guy, and I couldn't wear the mask until I got to the arena. I had to barter with a guy driving his own car. They didn't even have cabs back then. They just come around with a flag on top of their old car. And it was an old Buick. And when I got in the back seat, I'm thinking, man, I'm the man now. Look at me. I'm a semi-main event tonight. Guatemala City. I got this whole city stirred up. We got to the back towards the arena, and I bent down the back of the car, put that mask on, come up, and the guy freaked totally out, slammed on the brakes, started screaming, crying, tell me to get out of the car, he's like motioning, and that's when they attacked me. And I'm thinking, oh, they're gonna do nothing. Those Guatemalan people were really little, they were smart Japanese people, but man, as a group, they got that guy's car to rocking, right? And I'm going, nah, this ain't gonna happen. I mean, you know, I'd already locked the doors. Anyway, they got it rocking. It rocked up on the side. Then it rocked on over. Then I'm on the roof. And I'm looking at the most unusual thing to see at my age. I'm looking back, and I can see it as clear as day. I'm standing on the dome light, and I'm looking under the front seat of probably a 58 Buick. And it's just all kinds of nasty stuff with the springs and everything. And I'm crying like a baby. I'm thinking I'm going to die. I'm going, oh, no. The guy's on the floor, well, it's the roof. He's crawling around, and they kicked out the windows. And then it just went dead silent. And I'm going, this is a trick. They're trying to trick me to come out now, right? And I look, and there's a guy's little white glove, and he's making a motion like, come out. And I see his brown uniform sleeve. And then he opens the door, and I see a little chrome helmet. And I see an Uzi. And then I see all these people laid out all over the place. And the army is the ones that had all the authority down there. The police were crooked in Guatemala City. So anyway, but that was an experience. When I got out of that car and I realized that I was safe and I had the army surrounding me, now I'm tough. Come on. All right. Yeah, come on over here now.
It's funny.
Still wiping the tears out of my eyes.
It's funny the effect an Uzi has on a crowd of people, huh?
Well, Well, sometimes you don't know you're lighting a fuse when you're young. And then when you just go ahead and blow them up, I mean, there's places where I remember them coming real easy. They came real easy in the Bahamas a couple of times, Nassau, Puerto Rico, they came real easy down there. I mean, here they come. Looks like the whole side's coming in the ring over here. I mean, you know, and you're kind of like, it's a mass confusion. It's almost like an earthquake or something going off because nobody knows really where to go or who to hit. You know, so the one thing that I learned from old timers was get under the ring. Get out of the ring, kid. You stand a chance under there. Anyway.
Wow. Yeah, this is Steve. We definitely don't want to keep you all day, but one of the things that Jeff and I do when we get really off topic, and as I always say, we like to discuss and we like to break cave, not just on wrestling, but we like to break cave on food, movies, music. Jeff, what else do we like to break cave on?
Life.
On life. But Jeff, so we are going to be in Tampa in 2 weeks, Steve, and we're doing our next fan fest. You were a huge part of two of those fan fests, obviously, where you were the featured guest with Bob Roop discussing your feud from 40 years ago. But getting off topic, as we so often like to do, we are going to be going out to dinner one night in Tampa. Where should we go?
What do you want to eat?
I think we're looking
for something. The thing about that, that's got to be, you guys are asking me the number one question that my wife and I go through every day. What's for dinner? I mean, yeah. You know, it's like, can you ask me anything else? I mean, you know, who beat you in 92 or whatever, uh-huh. But to go eat, you know what? Tampa is just, it's just like every place, and you know, they got so many restaurants. There's so many good choices, but it's the timing a lot of times, like if you go on a weekend night or if you go late because of now they're not, you know, it's not famous when they're firing up everything, but you tell me what you want to eat and I could probably direct you. The steakhouse that I really like is Frontier Cattle Company, and it's on Sly Avenue off of 301. And when if you went there, you'd go, oh, man, the guy is a river. Look where we're eating. We're in a farmhouse. It looks like a farmhouse there. And it's, you know, it's not the greatest. Like, it's not like Burns Steakhouse. It's so famous. But they cook the steak and they smoke it on citrus branches.
Oh.
They use citrus branches to smoke the meat. And it's phenomenal. I mean, you know.
What's that, Jeff, are you writing this down?
I think we may have a group a group experience at that restaurant, Steve.
Yeah, well, they also have like, you know, with John Candy and Great Outdoors, they have the huge steak, a 95-pound steak or something that if you can finish it, you know, you get to eat it for free and then die. I mean, you know, but you know, it's an out of the off the wall place, and it's just kind of out of there, but it's not like a chain. You know, you can get a lot of good food at different restaurants, and you know, I like Italian food. I like all kinds of food. I mean, you know, so we went through this last night. I came home from, they had a charity here in Tampa for some underprivileged kids that I went to, and then my wife says, well, what do you want to eat? I'm going, I don't know. You know, it's Friday night. And we went to Carrabba's, and I usually get good food there, but I didn't get that good of food. But it was like 9 o'clock. And so, you know, I don't think, you know, they're excited about cooking anymore. So that's why I say timing's an important thing.
Yeah. So, well, listen, Steve, we really want to thank you for going out of your way and helping us discuss the life and the legacy of Dick Slater and your own career. We didn't know we were going to get that from you, but we appreciate it. And, you know, if you look back on Dick, as we talked about it, are your memories greater of Dick in the ring or outside the ring?
Outside.
Yeah.
My memories are Dick growing up with him in high school. Funny things happen as high school kids. I mean, sure. You know, doing stupid stuff. I mean, you know, we did a bunch of stupid stuff, like ride on the hood of your car going across a bridge, Gandy Bridge, 7 miles long, and you're on the hood of the car going 70. you know, switching cars, pulled up because we all had old cars, 55s, 57 Chevys, pull up beside each other, and the whole car on this side from the 55 shifts over to the 57, and the whole car from the 57 over to the 55, grabbing the center post and pulling yourself through. I mean, you know, some unbelievable stuff on the water. We're surrounded by water here. We all love the water. We were in the water a lot. Mike Graham had boats that would go so fast your hair would catch on fire. You'd be terrified until he stopped the boat. But did a lot of exciting things. My memories of Dick were more pre-wrestling than it were, you know,
well, of course,
after we got into the business.
When you're in high school, you think you can live forever, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, Steve, it's been great talking with you. And I'm sure Barry would agree with me on that. And if we're able to, we'd like to have you on down the road. We didn't even talk about Memphis, for God's sakes. We'd love to talk about Memphis one day.
Yeah, that's the problem with having that long of a career. You got plenty to talk about. You know, you just pick an era. I mean, you know, so.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you guys having me on. I really do. You know,
it's been an honor for us.
I feel bad about the whole thing, and I'm kind of tired about Barry and friends. It seemed like I just blinked my eyes from Jim the Anvil Neidhart's funeral, and then, you know, it's later. I mean, you know, and anyway.
Sure.
That's life.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate
it. Good talking to you guys.
Okay, Steve, you have a great day.
Thank you, Steve. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, see y'all.
And we certainly appreciate Steve Kern for his time. Great interview. Some great stories. Barry, I'm thinking about those guys being on the hood of that car going across the Gandy Bridge.
Those are some crazy stories, but I got to tell you, Jeff, and as we do whenever we discuss food in any form, citrus branches. Holy cow. FanFest cannot come soon enough. I am going. I don't care if I've got to go by myself. I am going to get a steak on citrus branches. I've never heard of that. I am making a beeline for this friggin' restaurant.
we may have to skip Portillo's this time.
We may have to, exactly.
So, okay, now next, we are going to go to a talk we had with Bob Roop. Now, in fairness, Steve grew up as Dick Slater's friend in high school. They knew each other a long time. Bob Roop, of course, as we're going to discuss, was one of the guys that was there when Dick first broke into Florida and started wrestling. And then later, Bob had a, dare I say, a professional conflict with Dick that we're going to go into. This is not meant to trash the memory of Dick Slater. But as I said in the very beginning, Dick Slater was a complicated man. He had various out of the ring issues. And so that's one of the things that we're going to discuss. And before we go to Bob Roop, Barry, I want to take a moment to mention our friend Ian Totten and his book, The House of Silver Doors. Again, Ian has stepped forward and he has re-upped with us as a sponsor, and we would like to encourage all of the fans out there that listen to our show to check out Ian's book. It's done in the vein of Stephen King's book, It, Salem's Lot, that kind of creepy stuff. Got a little potential scary tone to it, Barry.
It does too. And I, you know, so for me, with Halloween coming right up, Jeff, I am going to say I'm going ahead, I'm going to order this book. And I've read part of it because he was kind enough to share some of the chapters. But I am going to order this book, and I am making a special night for myself on Halloween around 10:30 at night when everybody goes to bed. I am going to turn out all the lights. I'm going to get a flashlight. I'm going to read Ian's book, and I'm hoping to be scared as shit, to be honest with you.
And we'd like to encourage you all to check out Ian's book. It's available at Amazon.com, The House of Silver Doors. So next, Barry, I think it's time we go to our interview with Bob Roop, the All-American back jumper. Bob talks about his life and his career that he spent with Bob when Bob was first training Dick Slater as he was first breaking into the Florida area, and a rather unfortunate incident that took place towards the Knoxville area that Bob's going to tell us about as we discuss the life and the legacy of Dick Slater. Okay, we are very happy to be joined by friend of the show, Bob Roop, for a second appearance with us here on Breaking Kayfabe. Bob, how you doing today, buddy?
Good, very good. Nice talking to you.
Thank you. And our, of course, friend Barry Rose is with us here. And we are going to be discussing the life and the legacy of Dick Slater, who we just lost a couple of days ago. Barry, how you doing?
I'm doing good and excited to have Bob back with us. Jeff, am I wrong, or is this the first time we've ever had a guest on twice.
I believe you are correct, sir.
Wow.
So we are going to be doing a little bit of a dive into the career of Dick Slater, and more importantly, into the beginning of the career of Dick Slater, because Bob, as I understand, you were right there on hand and were one of the people that helped train Dick when he first started out.
Yeah, when I broke in, he had not started yet. He was still, he and I are, I think, 11 years difference in age. So he was still in his, maybe late, maybe not that much, but he wasn't, he was hanging around with Mike Graham, but he wasn't working yet. So I saw him occasionally, but then when he did break in, he started hanging out more and more. I'd see him at the Sportatorium a lot. And when he did break in, he was a natural. You know, I was not envious, but I admiring, because he took to it right away. And I try to analyze things, and I try to figure out why that was the case. Where, I'll give you real quick psychobabble here. I was kind of formed and established at age 26 when I broke in. I'd been in the service. I had done college and finished, and my 13-year amateur background, I was established as a person. So to become a performer and a showman, I had to carry all that personality already developed with me. Now, sure, to extrapolate, since you used the word egregious in private, I have to trot out one big one. To extrapolate, I think when Dickie broke in, I think that he was more of a, not an empty vessel, but one that the script lines had not yet been written, as far as the kind of personality he displayed in the ring. So I think he was far better able to, in his own mind, go out there and visualize himself in the role of a professional wrestler and perform his actual physical behavior in that mode. And I had to overcome a bunch of stuff first. But I do remember really thinking, man, this guy is, you know, he's precocious as heck. He's because he took to it right away.
Yeah, that's one of the things too. And yeah, I've been watching wrestling for four decades at this point, and there are a few wrestlers that I remember were as good as Dick Slater right out of the gate. So tell us a little bit about the early training, because a lot of the obituaries that Jeff and I both read this past week had you as one of his initial trainers.
Well, yes, in a sense, it was as far as the pro stuff, not me, because I was kind of green myself. I mean, I could have shown the bit. You know, usually you show a guy a headlock and take over, and you know, two or three basic moves, and then you know, if he has any with me because of some background, they trotted me out there pretty quickly. I mean, they put me in very small shows with guys like John Heath and Don Curtis, who had amateur backgrounds, to get me used to being in the ring. But with where I came in and training Dickie, and it was him, and I think it was just once. So, you know, that training needs to have some quotation marks around it, because it might have been just one session, but it was him, Ron Fuller, Paul Orndorff, and Mike Graham. And Mike was already working, of course, but Eddie had this fixation about, I don't want to say shooting, but he wanted to have guys that, and this is not a bad thing. He wanted to have guys that could handle themselves in the ring, you know, in case somebody, you know, a fan jumped in the ring or whatever the case might be, in case maybe one of the boys would lose his mind and, you know, and try to grab a shooting hold or something. And so he had me working out with guys, and what we did is we were at the Sportatorium, and all five of us, well, Eddie was watching, but and you know, the guys would take turns going in the ring, and we just start on our feet and do takedowns, and then I showed them a few things, a front face lock, and I mean, I learned these things myself, mainly to defend myself. I wasn't really interested in using them, but Carol Matsuda broke me in, and we didn't know each other at all. And we go on our feet for like 45 minutes, and I this is not the hero. I loved him dearly, but you know, I'm sad he's not with us anymore. But early on, he broke in the hard way in Japan. Those guys got brutalized to make sure that they were committed. I mean, just absolutely chargeable offenses, assault and battery. They got brutalized when they were being broken in. And so he wanted to make sure he, you know, I mean, his famous one, I guess, is breaking Terry Bollea, Hulk Hogan's ankle or whatever, to make sure he was, you know, was dedicated. But Hero did the same thing with me. He did a couple of things that were questionable in terms of, like, a straight workout. They could have hurt me if I didn't know how to react. And I just immediately turned on my – one time I was in the referee's position with my feet, my toes down, and he dropped a knee. When we started, he dropped a knee on my Achilles tendon. If I hadn't been able to adjust, he could have done a bunch of things. He could have, the worst case, ruptured the tendon, broke my ankle, dislocated it, even in the best case. But I just immediately turned with it, and I reached up and grabbed him by the hair and stuck my thumb, not in his eye, but like on his eyebrow, to let him know, I'm not sure what you're doing here, sir, but if you persist, you're going to have to do it with only half your vision. And he immediately stopped, of course, and he never did anything. He never tried anything after that. I think that he felt, rightfully so, that I was qualified. Now, I'm sorry, you guys have got an old man over here, and, you know, long-winded. Just real briefly with Hero, extrapolate from that. And around the wrestling office, that place was a snake pit, and he was very, very reserved and very closed off. Even when he was running the place in later years when I was booking there, he was coming into Japan one time as I was leaving, and we were met at the airport, and my plane got delayed by 6 or 7 hours. And Hero and I sat there and drank beer for 4 or 5 hours to the extent I got on a plane and there was 6 of those seats in the middle open. I slept all the way back to the United States. But we laughed and joked. It was a completely different person. I mean, just, you know, I saw a side of him I never saw before, where he was one of the boys. He was away from his ownership responsibilities in the Florida office. He had 10 points, I think, out of the 100. So he showed his real personality, which was very warm and friendly and good sense of humor, smart guy. So I don't want to, like, blacken his name with this dropping on my ankle thing. His goal was to prove that, to want to find out for himself if you were dedicated, because he had probably had some guys come in the business from either maybe not just amateur wrestling, but say pro football, guys who had a name that were not what he considered dedicated. They were going to go out there and you know, not try to make a good, you know, not take care of themselves. And also, you know, he didn't want to have any of these people be able to have someone from the audience come in there and beat them up or take them down and make a fool out of them, because that injured, you know, the reputation of all of us. So I don't blame his attitude. But anyway, what I did is just with Slater and the rest of them, I just showed them how to defend themselves mostly.
Well, but, let me ask you, Bob. So, you know, you were talking about the Slater has always had the reputation, although he was, you know, generally regarded as a real tough guy, he was not a guy that's, you know, let's be honest, he didn't have any sort of amateur background. So, you know, he wrestled in high school and such, though, but he didn't have any kind of, you know, national background like you would have had. So when you talk about the snake pit, was he a guy that was going into the snake pit like you and Hero and Jack Briscoe, or was he just a guy that happened to be there for a couple of days?
He was breaking in, and you're right, he didn't have the chops. You know, a few people did, of Jack, you know, and myself, but we spent years, you know, we spent college and,
sure.
And, so, I mean, he didn't pursue it. No, he didn't have that level of, when I worked out with him, and again, this is not to disparage him, but, you know, I was world class. And I had no problem. He couldn't defend himself against me, and I wasn't that much bigger. and I wasn't much stronger, and I could take him down with ease. So I never had an idea. He reacted like a wrestler. Now, working out with someone like a football player or like a basketball player, like Ron Fuller, is dangerous for a wrestler because they don't know how to react. And you know, a wrestling feint, like a fake move to try to get them, you know, in a position where you can shoot a takedown, maybe have them step back or step forward by the way you move your body. Wrestlers are trained to react in certain ways, but these other guys aren't. I had some of my worst injuries, and they were usually a knee to the face working out with football players because I'd make a move where they should draw their leg back. Instead, they'd go to defend themselves, and they'd bring a knee forward, and I'd catch it right in the face. So I had to learn not to go directly in on any of these guys. They'd go out to the side. But Dickie didn't, he did have the defensive actions of a wrestler. But as far as, and with the other guys, I don't remember them, whether he was a great takedown guy. Nothing stands out. But it might have been.
I think the general consensus is that, you know, while on the mat, Slater might not have been in your class or a Jack Briscoe's class, where you do want Slater to have your back is like if you're in a bar room setting, because that's where he and guys like Harley Race and maybe Wahoo, that's where they really were at their strong point. Would that be fair to say?
Yes. But I'm sorry. I just have to qualify that. Harley Race, I was ever in a bar with Wahoo, and I know Wahoo was a tough guy. Harley was a tough, dangerous man. Harley had, when I first met him, he had a bite mark on the back of his hand. The imprint of someone's upper teeth that was just healing. And I asked him about it. And we had just gone 45 minutes in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and to me, 45 minutes seemed like 10 years. And with Harley, it went by just like quick. I mean, he just was a beautiful. I was green. I had about a year in the business, and just a beautiful match. And so we were talking down the road or sometime later, and I asked him about the hand, and he'd been in a bar, and somebody was giving him trouble, and he didn't give any kind of indication. He just backhanded the guy in the mouth. And he had to follow up with whatever, if he kicked him in the head or hit him with a chair, but the fight was over and Harley went back to his beer in about like 5 seconds after it started. The only other guy I ever saw with that mark was a guy named McGinnis, who was alone, was like a Rocky. He was a loan shark collector, and he had the same, his was the same thing. It was a backhand of the chops. And when I say deadly dangerous, it's the toughness to be able to do that is a state of mind. The actual way that you implement your toughness can be more lethal with some people. And Harley is in a completely different league. I don't know about Wahoo, but Harley's in a different league than most people, including me. I have these tricks that I know from learning about it from them. But if I had ever had to fight, I wouldn't, but without knowing those things, I wouldn't have been able to do them because I didn't have the same mindset. Harley and I had completely different backgrounds. But Dickie was, there was a story that there was this pro football player that was scared to death of him. And I just never, I'm not trying to belittle Dickie and I'm not trying to elevate myself. I just never saw the need to be afraid of him. You use your ESP, your instincts, and all that. Well, I mean, he had no reason to be. Well, yeah, he did. We actually had violence between us, which is very rare for pro wrestlers. I mean, real violence outside the ring. But I never felt threatened by him in the sense that I was any fight. If you're not afraid, you're crazy because you can get hurt. But I was never afraid to the point of like really deathly afraid like I was when I almost got killed in Iraq. I mean, it was just absolute PTSD type of afraid. And that's not to put Dickie down. I'm sure that just the idea that he enjoyed that reputation, and or if he did, I'm not sure, but if he did. And the other thing is, when I hung around with him, I mean, we were at bars and all different things. I never saw any of that. I never saw him pushing his way around. And I mean, to him, this just speaks to him in terms of his level of behavior and class. I never saw him, you know, here's the two of us that probably could maybe take any three guys in the bar. Although that's, let me back off on that, because the bar is real dangerous. One guy in the right position could have beat the two of us. But, you know, I never saw it. We hung around, and he just kind of hung in there with me, and I was never looking for trouble. So, I never saw that, but I heard about it. I heard a lot about it. I mean, the boys like to, you know, telephone, telegraph, tell a wrestler. The boys love to talk about stuff like that. And he had the rep. I agree with you about that.
Gotcha. So you just, a couple of minutes ago, or a few minutes ago, you mentioned Wahoo McDaniel and Dick Slater. And wasn't there an incident, and I'm not sure if it was Florida or Georgia, that involved Wahoo, Dick Slater, and a gun?
Yeah, Dickie was coming. I was booking in Knoxville, and Dickie was, I knew him, and he was real friends, good friends with Bobby Jr., and he was coming in. You know, he's a good talent. I was glad to have him. And so he was scheduled to come in. I get this call that he'd been in a bar with Wahoo, and Wahoo pulled out a gun for some reason. It wasn't against him. It was an accident. But he ended up getting shot in the knee. So I don't remember. It seemed like we sent someone from Knoxville to go get him and drive his car because he couldn't drive. And drive him, I think they were in Atlanta, and drove him to Knoxville. And he stayed on my, he laid on the couch in my living room for like, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks while he was healing. And he was booked, you know, we had to substitute his matches. And, Ron Fuller wasn't happy because I asked Dickie, I had gotten a guarantee for Dickie, and I asked Ron to pay him even though he wasn't working, which, you know, I look back, I think I was maybe asking a little much, but the business, we were doing great business. Ronnie Garvin and Malenko were just, you know, were hot. The Stomper was there. I mean, you know, the territory was on fire. So Ryan could certainly afford it. And so I got Dickie paid while he was laying on my couch. And he was, I don't know exactly, he never told me the details. I mean, I imagine if he'd seen it coming, he would have jumped in the air or something. But he ended up getting shot, and I never asked Wahoo about it either. I wonder if there's somebody out there who might know that story, but I'm sorry, I don't know more. I know the resulting scenario from it, but not actually how it happened.
Gotcha. Jeff, did you have a question for Bob?
Yeah, well, one of the things, you know, that Dickie was very well known for, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it, is, you know, there's sort of a first part of Dickie's career and a second part. And one of the things that, you know, when he first broke in the business in Florida, and we're talking, you know, the mid 70s, you know, plus a little past that, he was always regarded as a guy who people could see potentially as a future world champion. He was that talented and that gifted from the get go. But then towards the second part of his career, he became seemingly obsessed with Terry Funk. And if you're going to emulate anybody, Lord knows Terry Funk is a great person to emulate because he's an all time great. But he seemed like he was going out there, and there was a lot of let me do my tonight. I'm going to be Terry Funk. Did you get a bit of that as you watched him?
Oh, I got a barrel load of it. He actually, it was pathological. He became left-handed. Terry's left-handed, you know, and Dickie isn't. He started actually. I think he wanted to be Terry Funk. And not just when I talked again about when I talked about earlier about, you know, mentally trying to project and figure out why people do the thing they're, you know, behave the way they do. He was, in a sense, an empty shell in terms of having a formed personality. So he liked Terry's personality. Terry was, you know, extremely talented. Although, see, in that sense, the gap between him and Terry and talent wasn't that much. I mean, it was still pretty wide. but wasn't that much. In terms of experience, it was oceans wide. It was exponentially. Terry grew up in the business. I mean, he had forgotten more than Dickie probably ever learned. But he had, plus Terry was universally respected and liked. I mean, Terry would do stuff. He would rib on the square. I mean, I remember sitting in a dressing room with the Florida promoters all in a room and three or four or five of the boys changing, and Terry's making jokes. You know, he was part of he was a promoter himself in Amarillo, and Terry's making these jokes on the square about promoters being thieves and stealing money from wrestlers. Yeah, and he's laughing when he says it, so the promoters are laughing, but he was ribbing on the square. What he was doing is insulting the crap out of them and calling them thieves, and they were laughing right along with him. Well, that's a rare talent. You know, Terry had the, he's a very, very intelligent person. And Dickie wanted to be him. He started walking like him and dressing like him, and just, he wanted to be Terry Funk. He didn't want to be like Terry Funk. He wanted to be Terry Funk. I looked at him with a bit of a jaundiced eye. He imitated other people. He imitated Dusty for a while, too. Not so much in looks, of course, because there's a remarkable physical difference, but his behavior. He became very flamboyant, like Dusty was, for a while. Not long. I don't think that suited him that well, but... I think he was able to take on, I mean, the wrestling business is show business, and, you know, you act out, some people actually acted out too much, they become, you know, bipolar or multi-personality disorder, but, you know, you act out roles, and he wanted to have the real-life role of being Terry Funk, which, you know, I understand why Terry would love the guy. You know, any imitation is a censorious form of flattery. If someone actually wants to be you, I mean, how more flattering could you be? So, anyway, it was a little off-putting to me, though, because, again, I already had 3 years in the service, too. I had a completely different mindset to Dickie, and I didn't know his background, you know, in terms of him growing up, and we never talked about it. He never had much to say. I didn't talk about mine with him, and he didn't talk. We never talked at that level, I don't think. It was always superficial and about the business or what's going on, what might be ahead, not anything about the past. So I don't know much about his background. I knew that.
Bob, can I ask you a question? I don't mean, because I know Barry's going to take the next question, but did you ever share a car with Dick on a road trip, you know, from town to town?
Yeah. I stayed with him in Tampa for... We were close at one time. I stayed with him in an apartment in Tampa for a week when he was gone and a week when he was there. And, we hung around, you know, quite a bit. Like I say, I never felt a real connection. I liked him okay. I mean, it's flattering that, you know, a guy wants to be around you. But he was always kind of the sidekick, you know. He never said much and just kind of followed me around. And I wasn't. I mean, I'm looking back at this now. I didn't see it that way at the time. I knew it. I knew Dick.
Yeah, so one of the... we're talking about Terry Funk, and Terry Funk is... I guess I consider myself extremely fortunate that I was able to see so much of his career and able to see him live. And I've gone on record, Bob, saying that I think one of the greatest wrestling matches I ever saw was the match that took place in 1976 at the Miami High Life Fronton when you challenged Terry Funk for the NWA World's Heavyweight title. And it was a great match, and it was essentially, you were one of the top heels in the state. I think it was in the middle of the feud that you had with Steve Kern at the time, which was, we've discussed, one of the greatest feuds, I think, in the history of professional wrestling, not just the state of Florida. But this match against Terry Funk was fantastic. Did you and Terry ever work a program together outside of, because in Florida, I don't believe it ever happened, but in another territory, did you guys ever work against each other?
I new information for you, and that's great, because that's what life is. Is as long as you want to stay healthy and progress and keep learning. We did. When Harley was booking, I was helping him, and I got I got the towns. I got all the towns. Like Monday was Orlando and West Palm Beach. So Harley would you know, Orlando was about 90 miles from Tampa, and West Palm was, I don't know, 200 between 2 and 250. So I was running West Palm for, I don't know, about 6, 7, 8 months, I think. And Terry and I got into a program down there. And you talk about, you were here I am, and I'm still learning, and I mean, we all are every day, hopefully, but in the business, I'm still learning the ropes in a sense and about booking. And I get in a program in West Palm with Tim to where every week, you know, we were doing things on TV, but every week we could get together in West Palm because you could get to the locker rooms are separated, but there's a way in the back that you could get together. And we would talk over, you know, finishes and things. And he was, you know, he was very deferential. He wasn't pushy or, you know, like saying, hey, I'm a vet, real vet here. You're, you know, kind of a newbie. But the way I felt, and certainly looking at it now, he was a professor emeritus. I might have been like a freshman in college. And, you know, talking with him and coming up with ideas and programs and things. You talk about an end value in terms of, you know, helping me move forward in my own career, and certainly as a booker and my own, providing my own, you know, when you're trying to get over in a territory, if you know how to help yourself, a big help. If you can tell the promotion how to actually get you over or at least help in doing that, it's a big help. So, yeah, Terry and I had about 6 months, and that was just beautiful. And the matches, of course, learning in the ring. We very seldom ever had to say anything to each other. And, you know, even though I was the heel, he would lead did parts, and I would lead parts. And it was just, it was beautiful. I mean, it was, he was a genius, you know. He was a genius. He's completely different from Junior. But they were both geniuses in the ring. They had their own style. And Senior, I got to watch him work out in Amarillo. He was same thing. I know where their smarts came from. He was a very, very intelligent guy and a great worker. You know, he's still in the ring, old, bald, kind of like I look now. And he could go in there and, I thought it was always funny. He wore a Holiday Inn towel down the ring with him around his neck. And he would go in there and never went off his feet. He'd be in the ropes itself, but he it was over. He had him. People believed him. He still drew money. You know, he was probably in his 50s or 60s. He would have been in his 60s by then, probably. So, anyway, those guys, what great talents.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, there's not a lot of history about Dory Sr. as time has progressed and gone on. Did you ever have a chance to go and talk to him in the office?
Not a lot, but, you know, you heard the stories and everything. Terry and I hung around out there some, because when I started out there as a babyface, but, when I came a heel, we couldn't mingle, but, you know, I heard the story and, you know, they would be able to verify it, but that the way they promote, one of the promotional tools they used in Amarillo was Terry and Senior would go out to the bars and wait for somebody to say something and get into a brawl and get arrested and or at least get into the brawl and maybe pay for the damages or whatever. But, you know, the word got out. These guys, these pro wrestlers, these so-called phonies, these guys are tough. I don't know about the rest of those guys, you know, but these two guys are the real deal. And it was, you know, it was a great promotional tool. And, you know, I imagine bail, you know, was expensive. But, you know, after a while, they were so well known there that they got away with stuff that nobody in the world could get away with without being arrested. And, you know, some of the stuff I saw hanging around with Terry. But, Senior was a very intelligent man, educated, but also world, you know, world-wise and wise to the ways of the world, and good promoter, good guy, funny, great sense of humor, very pleasant to be around. But anybody that would underestimate his intelligence would be making a big mistake. Well, what am I talking about? Him, Eddie Graham, and Bob Geigel all had their own guys be world champions. Dory had two of them, both his sons, world champion. Eddie had Jack Briscoe, and Geigel had Harley. You know, they, those guys, yeah, they were smart because they had to get the rest of promoters to agree to do it. But by voting together in a block, they were able to, you know, they had some sway. They probably promised, okay, when this guy gets through, we'll vote for your guy or whatever. I don't know how they did it, but by, you know, like at our Congress today, but in their little convention every year, they had that three-vote block that was very powerful. And so, yeah, they were smart. I mean, that's the smartest thing. You get a guy go out and be a world champion and travel everywhere. You get him out of your own territory for 2 or 3 years, and then he comes back, and you give him a little time off to rest, and then you got a guy who's back in your territory, he's one of your main stars, who's been a world champion. I mean, you just, how better, you couldn't do any more in your own territory than you already have to get him over, but you've got him over by him not being there, which is, you know, somebody else paid to get him over, even stronger, which is really smart business when you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So, Bob, so in your career, you really were all over the world. I know you spent a lot of time in Australia. You spent time, you know, all throughout the United States. You were in Japan. Was there anybody that you saw during your travels that you said, this guy is going to draw money? This guy is going to be absolutely a star in the professional wrestling business, and then for whatever reason, it didn't happen. Was there anybody that really made an impression like that on you?
Well, I want to say a young, I think his name was in Houston, Gino Hernandez. Is that the right name?
Yes.
He wasn't in the business yet, but he was hanging around when I worked out there, for about 7-8 months. And I thought, you know, it's sort of a delayed thing because he had such looks. He had these great looks and, you know, his father was a wrestler, his family. And so, I thought that he had, all kinds of potential. And I guess he was very good, but he had the demons that, you know, a lot of guys have and, you know, he kind of self-destructed, but I thought that he was going to be somebody really special. Let me think in terms of breaking in guys.
I tell you what, Bob, while you're thinking about that, let me ask you the flip side of that question. Did you ever have anybody that you thought to yourself, this guy's never going to be anything in the business, and ended up actually having a pretty decent career?
I can't really think of anybody. I was never playing politics when I was in the business. You know, I did my own thing. If I wasn't happy someplace, I just left. And I didn't make a lot of close friendships. Hard in the business, you know, because, you know, a lot of times when I first started, Jack Briscoe and I were good friends. We traveled together, and then once I came a heel, I couldn't travel with him anymore, you know, and it's a shame, you know. You really can't get together in public at your apartment or theirs unless you're out somewhere, you know, where nobody can see you. So it's difficult to have enduring friendships. And I'm lucky. I'm still good friends with Ronnie Garvin and Jim Raschke. I never even worked on a show with him, but we were friends before we got into business, either one of us, and we're still good friends to this day. And I would have been good friends with Timmy Woods. I was, but he's passed. What a shame. I just had gotten back with him after some 20 years. I knew him when I was in high school. He was at Michigan State. And he and Jim were responsible for getting me in the Hall of Fame. You talk about a voting block. I had those two guys push me for the committee was all the boys voted for, the guys who were in the hall voted for the next class. And those two not together, but they both pushed when my name came up. They both said, yeah, because, you know, we were friends. They liked me and they knew they valued my amateur chops more than a lot of the guys did. I think probably Mad Dog Rashawn would have too. He might have gone along with it too, because back in 2006, the amateur part was still a big part of being inducted. And I'm not saying that it isn't today, but the museum needs to survive. In order to do that, you need to have fans come. And so they have gone more in years, more with the name of the pro side than with the amateur chops, which I have absolutely no problem with that, because, you know, if you're in a museum, you should want the museum to survive whatever it takes, as long as you're, you know, not ripping people off. Otherwise, you know, your stature of being in the Hall of Fame, if the Hall of Fame is defunct, you're no longer in it, are you?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So Bob, circling back to Dick Slater too. So you were, if I'm correct, you were responsible for bringing Dick into the Knoxville area, and then it unfortunately led to a falling out with your friendship. Would you want to share that story with us?
Yeah, you know, no moral judgments, but just what happened was one of the things we wanted to do was going opposition. I had gone to the promoter twice about the payoffs, and I was just countered. I got no satisfaction from the answers, let's put it that way. So we were talking about it. I was going to leave. I was just going to give my notice and leave, because you can only be robbed if you allow yourself to be. Even though I was a booker, I was going to give my notice and, you know, I'd give a month or 2 weeks at least and leave. But, you know, that's the only way you could protest, really. You know, I was making good money, but I was getting shortchanged. So, but
now, Bob, if I could interrupt you just for 1 second, just for clarification, are you talking about Ron Fuller or someone else?
Ron Fuller.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify. Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted.
Well, you know, I just didn't get satisfaction from, and I knew Ron, you know, I talked about helping break him in down there in Tampa years before. You know, I never heard of any of those guys, so I'm sure if I had, he would have not had me want to have me come and work for him in Knoxville. But, you know, and we were talking, and I was going to leave, and I think it was Ronnie that brought it up. I'm not trying to pass the buck here, but because I went along with it. But Ronnie said, why don't we take the territory? And Ron was actually working, and he had a promotion in Florida somewhere, and or somewhere in the South.
Pensacola.
And yeah, Robert was down there booking, and Ron went down there to work. So here we are, basically, Malenko, Ronnie, and I were... Ronnie had all these great experiences as a booker, and Malenko had all this experience from his years as a heel. And we put together some stuff. I was mostly the guy offering bad ideas if they could come up with something better. And the three of us came up with this, just some beautiful stuff. And a lot of people, you know, hated the theatrical part of it. But what they didn't understand, you know, okay, I'm old school. I don't like this stuff. We bring people down to the ring in a big carton box and all that. What they didn't understand was after we did that, that helped get the people in the building. After they did that, then Ronnie and Malenko, or me and Bobby and against whoever we were wrestling, would go out and have a hell of a match. I mean, we give them, you know, so we got them there in the building, and then we'd go out. It wasn't like, okay, the box was a whole deal. The box was just unwrapping the present. The present was the match. And we had these great matches afterwards, but they were these so-called purists and old timers said, all that crap just makes the business. No, it doesn't make the business look bad. What makes the business look bad is an empty auditorium. When the auditorium's full and people are screaming and crying and going crazy and they come back week after week, you tell me that's hurting the business? Not if you're not killing it by, you know, hot shotting every week. And we weren't doing that. We had a great thing going. I had those two great experienced guys as like senior advisors. I was in charge, but only really technically. Well, I was getting paid extra, so yeah, I was, and I took the heat too, and willingly. That was my job, to be between the owner and the boys, leg in one camp and leg in the other. And it's hard to be management and staff at the same time, but the booker has to kind of try to do that. Otherwise, you lose the boys completely. And if you go to all the boys, you lose your job. So, but anyway, I had those two great guys, and we were making it. We were popping the territory, and the money wasn't there as a result of our labors. And when Ronnie said, let's take it, I've been thinking for years about trying to have a union. So I thought, well, if we had a basis here, oh, it's a beautiful territory too, short trips, and that is just beautiful, good weather. And so, you know, I could see staying there for years if possible. And so I thought, you know, we'd get a union. This would be the basis of having a union, and guys could come to work there who were, you know, had the same mindset we did, that we didn't want to be stolen from, and guys could come and work there and not have to worry about being blackballed. And, you know, if we made big stars of them, I don't care if other promoters said, oh, I'll never use that guy. If he's drawing money in Knoxville, well, when it's time for him to go, believe me, there'd be five or six promoters who forgot all that stuff about not using them. They see money. There's, you know, a prize heifer out there loose. They're going to go try to rope him in. So I never worried about that. But we were going to start a union. And to me, it made sense. Basketball, baseball, and football had done it. And all of a sudden, these guys that used to be slaves were millionaires. And I thought, hey, why not? And so that was my ultimate goal. And, you know, the idea of having an own promotion, of course, and all the things that come with it, the financial reward and all that was attractive, too. But Dickie and I had a falling out over that. He was part of our partnership, and if he had told me about it first, it would have been, there would have been some heat, but he could have still, he still could have had my respect. But he went and told the promoters, the NWA promoters, what we were doing, and he got my job. I was fired as a booker. He got the booking job. And I still had. We were still going to go off. We just couldn't tell them. I'd been fired. But I had 2 weeks. I was booked 2 weeks ahead. So I said I'll work out my notice. And so I had to walk around the dressing room. Dickie's walking around with the book, and I just swallowed it. You know, it's just that's life. That's the way things happen. But when we went opposition, we started. We start trying to demean their promotion, and also there's quite a bit of it personal. It wasn't just me; all of us. I mean, Bobby was upset too. He's the one that actually Dickie got booked with us through Bobby, and Bobby brought him forward. And I said, "Sure, you get good talent." So you know, all of us were very disappointed in him. You know, and felt betrayed and. But we put an ad in the Knoxville paper for everyone, for all our shows. We'd be running Knoxville the same night. We put a picture in there of Dickie and myself, and we have every match. We had a lights out match after the regular show was over. And, you know, he had to show up, loser's a chicken or something like that. So we was basically being insulted every week. Now, so that don't sound like a complete, you know, a knocker here, like I'm saying, well, yeah, you expect him to come to your show. I went to their show. I went to the Knoxville show by myself. And I don't remember why we weren't working that night, but whatever it was, I went to a Knoxville show. The police wouldn't let me in through the back where the boys come out. And they told me, no, we've been told you can't come in here. So I went and bought a ticket. And I sat as close as I could to the ring, and I wasn't threatening, I wasn't glaring, I wasn't making any kind of, you know, overt actions to be threatening. But of course, my very presence, you know, the fans knew what was going on. My very presence there, I'm sure, was disconcerting, and some of the boys might have worried I was going to come jump in the ring or something, but I was never going to do anything like that. But I just went to show that, look, you know, we're talking about credibility here. I'm not afraid to come to your show. I mean, I'm by myself. It's not me and Ronnie and Bobby and Malenko with his chain and, you know, Crusher Boomfield or whoever. No, I don't think. No, he was. Well, he still was. Anyway, it wasn't three or four. It was just me. And you know, I'm not a Bruiser Brody or you know some giant monster guy. But you know, I wasn't planning on attacking anybody. But I wanted to show that okay, I'm willing to come into your bailiwick. And it was to prove a point. If I'm willing to come to yours, why aren't you willing to come to ours? And so, you know, it created, of course, it put a lot of pressure on Dickie. And the violence resulted. I went into their bar, again by myself. And it was to force his hand, because after that stuff in the newspaper of calling him a coward, well, chicken, but, you know, that's worse. Probably coward would be better. You know, he had to do something. I mean, Andre was there and all the guys on that. They had a big card. And a lot of the guys were there. And I'm standing there in the bar by myself. Dickie had to do something. And we got into it. And in his book, Terry Funk wrote that Dickie beat me up. Let me preface by saying Jack Mulligan did beat me up, but he did hit me one time and knocked me for a loop. I happened to be looking in the other direction when he did it. Now, everybody says that. I know that. But believe me, if I saw Jack Mulligan getting ready to punch me, I would have ducked or something. But he knocked me for a loop. I managed to get out of there without getting killed. Jack had some problems. And he would, you know, later he sent word to the Iron Sheik that he was sorry. It was nothing I did. It was just he was having a bad day or some stuff like that. But so, I mean, I have been. Beaten in a contest of force. I left the dressing room because my eye was bleeding. I couldn't see it on my left eye. I was worried about losing it, that something had hit me so hard to where it was numb. I was worried about. So I left the dressing room to reconnoiter. Now, outside the dressing room, I did wait for a few minutes to see if he was going to come out by himself, and he didn't. So I went off to get my eye checked. But so I'm prefacing that by saying, no, I'm not Mr. Infallible, I can't be beat or whatever. But when I went into the bar with Dickie, I went by myself because, again, by putting the pressure on it. Oh, I know where I left it off. In Terry's book, and I've been wanting to talk to Terry, but I don't want to do it on the phone. But there's an inaccuracy. Dickie told him he beat me up. I'm telling you. Dickie Slater, the closest he got to me, he was trying to grab me by the hair. I had three guys holding me. He was trying to grab me by the hair so he, because I was bobbing and weaving, so he couldn't just walk up and blast me. And he had nobody holding him. And there's two guys still alive that can, one of them was holding me that can attest to this. But, you know, he was going to leave. And I called him back. And I said, what, you're getting ready to leave? I got three guys holding me, and you're going to weasel out? Because I knew that if he left, that the story would go out that he had beaten me and all that. I didn't, for business reasons and personal, too. I didn't want, so I called him back, and he came. The guys are still holding me for some reason. I don't know why. I should have beat them up, if anybody. But anyway.
Who are the guys holding you, Bob?
One of them was Hoot Gibson. The other two guys worked in the bar. They weren't boys. Okay. Hoot, later on, I asked him, Hoot, I said, why the hell were you holding me? I said, you're on my side. I said, you should have grabbed him. He said, well, I didn't think he could do anything, Bob. I was worried about you. I guess it's a compliment, but thanks, Hoot, you almost got me killed. But, yeah, hold Andre. Don't hold me. You know, go hold Andre by the leg so I can run. So Dickie came back, and he was going to, you know, you guys are holding me. He's going to try to punch me. Well, I had a blackjack in my boot, and I pulled it out, and I blasted him. I missed him. Kind of glancing the first time, I got him on a second one, and it rocked him pretty good, and it busted him open a little bit, and Tommy Rich came out of the bar about that time, and grabbed him, and Slater let him pull him out of the bar. If he had wanted to fight, he definitely could have kept going, but he said something about, oh, you had to use a blackjack. Oh, yeah, you're lucky I didn't have a bazooka, man. But that was the extent of our, you know, I wanted to tell Terry, because here I am belying his, well, you know what, it's good, because I already talked about Terry and how much I respect him. What I wanted to tell him was, Terry, you have been done an injustice, an in service, because in your book, if there's anything that's not true in your book. One misfact in there, or, you know, one unfounded part of your book, if it's not true, it lends to the credibility of everything else that's in there. So there's a misstatement in your book. Dickie Slater has never, ever laid even a fingernail on me in anger. And he never did. I think when we were working out in a sportatorium, we weren't trying to hurt each other, so there wasn't anger involved. And, you know, I don't have any problem admitting when I've been bested. You know, life has a way. You see those pictures of me lately. Life's been kicking my butt pretty good. But
life is still undefeated, Bob.
Yeah, I'm still here. You know, I'm still, we're going Broadway for the moment. I'm trying to make it about another 25-year match. But, and you know, it was unfortunate that happened. You know, Dickie had his demons like we all do. I don't think he was emotionally equipped, psycho Bible, but you know, to handle some of the things that he got himself into. And, you know, I think, you know, I lost track of him the last 25, 30 years. I'm not sure. I asked somebody the other day if they knew how he got into the wheelchair. And, you know, what happened to him. And I just forgot him. I didn't think about him. And, you know, I'm sorry that I got to be honest. I don't feel pain. But for those, I do feel compassion for those people who cared for Dickie, not for him himself. He got himself where he got, including his demise, in most chances, it wasn't like something happened to him in life by something else happening to him or somebody else doing something to him. He got there by himself. And so his demise, it might have been a relief to him in his final moments, maybe to know, well, at last his agony's over. But for any of the people like who do have fond memories and all that, I feel sorry. I'm sorry that you're feeling that compassion and that, you know, those condolences, and they're well merited because it speaks well to the people who are feeling them. You didn't see a side of Dickie that you weren't on the inside. You didn't see the demon side of Dickie that I did. And, you know, and but what we try to do now in our reunions and everything, all those grudges are forgotten and people are remembering the good things. On Facebook, I see it all the time. Any misunderstandings or arguments or disagreements are forgotten. And people are saying, hey, I remember when we did this and we did that. And they're thinking about good things. And that's the way life should be. If you want to have a happy, you know, or at least a contented older life, you got to let all that stuff go. And, I don't think Dickie was able to. I left many 30 years ago, and I've got a family, and my two boys and I still own a home together. And so, you know, I'm very happy with my life now. And, but again, for those people who are hurt or feeling any angst, pain or regrets or whatever with Dickie, his loved ones, people who loved him, you have my condolences. I feel sorry that I'm sorry that you feel that way. And I'm not saying it's not merited. Not what happened between me and Dickie was just between us. I'm not saying that he was that way with everybody. I'm sure with other people he, you know, had maybe very, very loving and relationships that were of value. Okay.
Before, just because we got to start wrapping up here, Barry, do you have one more thing you wanted to ask Bob?
Yeah, so Bob, there is a young man in our group by the name of Kevin Carter that is a huge fan of yours, and he was going to try to make it down to the last Fan Fest, and unfortunately couldn't make it down. His wife has been battling cancer for quite some time, and she continues to battle. He is a very, very strong supporter. He is the guy that you want by your side if you have to go through cancer, because he's a loving, devoted husband. And when I told him that you were going to be on the show this week, he goes, man, I'm super excited to hear it. So I wanted to give Kevin Carter a shout out. He's doing just a tremendous job in the fight against cancer that his wife is fighting. And I wanted you to know that you've got somebody that's a fan that really wanted to meet you and just unfortunately was not able to meet you.
Well, thank you for that. Is there any way that I could help him and his wife financially? I'm not talking about out of my pocket, but is there any way we could do get some guy? I might be able to round up some guys that would do it, you know, just for me to do autograph signings or something to try to raise some money for to help his wife out, you know, maybe get treatment to the cannabis. I don't know. Maybe they're all set. But if there's any way we can help, please pass it on to him and tell him thank you for, or I hope he can hear me himself, that, you know, when this airs, that his regard is very important to me. It means a lot. And I had a sick wife for a while, and she also had cancer, and I lost her. So I know what he's going through, but much worse with him. And so, you know, my best wishes and also my respect and admiration for being there for her. There's not a lot of people, not everybody can do that. It takes a lot of character for him to do that. And I'd be pleased to meet him, shake his hand and his wife's hand and wish her and him the best.
So, well, I'm sure Kevin will appreciate that. And we all send our best wishes to Kevin and his wife as they continue the struggle. Bob, listen, we got to tell you, we really appreciate you taking some time out to reminisce on the career of Dick Slater and your own career and some of the stuff that you had to tell us. We always love discussing wrestling history. That's our baseline here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdern and Barry. And we on behalf of Barry, we certainly appreciate your time discussing Dick Slater and your career.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I mean, without you guys, that career would be done and buried. And so it's still, it would be. Think about it. It's still, my career is still going on thanks to folks like you. And I tell you, it's the ultimate in respect and regard that you do that. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, but I'm going to try.
Okay. So thanks again, Bob, and we'll talk to you again. Okay, we want to thank Bob Roop, and we also want to thank Steve Kern, Barry, for this look back at the career of Dick Slater. Barry, I think you'll agree with me, as I said in the very beginning, Dick Slater, a man of complicated life. He was such an unbelievable talent in the ring early in his career. Physically, he started having some problems towards the end of his career, and then, of course, towards the end of his life.
Yeah, it's kind of a tragedy as well, and some people would say it's karma, whatever it is. I don't want to get into all that, but, you know, I want to go with what we were talking about when we first started the show, that Dick Slater, in his prime, was one of the best professional wrestlers, in my opinion, of all time, and I would just like to leave it at that.
Okay, and I will encourage you all to follow me on Twitter at Bowdern Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Barry, my daughter gets married at the end of this week. I am freaking out, man. Folks, we appreciate you listening, and we will talk to you next time.